When he was with her, he'd had a black eye from falling down drunk the night before. I got that. It made a lot more sense than taking half an hour to make a cocktail. Malcolm Lowry understood the siren call of superlatives, and Under the Volcano exposes its anti-hero, the consul, as a man dependent on the twin gods of booze and melodrama. Lowry himself was rabidly committed to the idea of writing not just a novel about alcoholism, but the best novel ever written about alcoholism. He believed his drinking could be redeemed only if it was transfigured into epic, writ large across a sweeping dramatic canvas. That was the hope he pinned on Under the Volcano, that it would redeem the wreckage of his life. As he described it later, he wanted to turn his greatest weakness into his greatest strength. Everything was outsized. His motivations, his ambitions, his dysfunction, his plot. And when Jackson published The Lost Weekend in 1944, Lowry was devastated and indignant. He had been working on Under the Volcano for almost a decade, sustained by the idea that he would write the first truly groundbreaking account of alcoholism. And he was heartbroken by the fact that Jackson had beaten him to the punch, not to mention the fact that Jackson's novel achieved such instant success, hitting bestseller lists immediately. Lowry judged Jackson's book for its absent layers of higher meaning, deeming its vision of boozing tedious, an insult to his vision of boozing tragic. But this snobbery was cold comfort. Jackson had still belittled his masterpiece by making it unoriginal. Lowry wanted a monopoly on tragedy, even though his novel exposed the foolishness of a drunkard's need to do just that. Published in 1947, Under the Volcano takes place on the Day of the Dead, as the consul drinks himself into the swift, leathery, perfumed, alcoholic dusk of a fictional Mexican town called Cuauhnahuac, based on Cuernavaca, where Lowry himself had lived and gotten grotesquely, ongoingly drunk. The consul has been left by his wife, Yvonne, and has spent the past year longing for her return. But once Yvonne arrives, all the consul can talk about is the bender he went on in Oaxaca after she went away. He has been hoping that her return can save him from himself, but it only ends the illusion that he could be saved by anything at all. The novel's plot, despite its fever dream pulse, is surprisingly faithful to the smallness of a drunk's life. We see the consul trying not to drink, sipping a strychnine concoction from a doctor, hunting for his hidden booze, trying to fuck his wife, failing to fuck his wife, trying not to drink, drinking anyway, passing out. Rather than offering some sentimental vision of whatever homes we make in the darkness, Under the Volcano illuminates these delusions from the inside. The novel does offer the drunkard as martyr and symbol, his booze a dark communion. The consul drinks as if he were taking an eternal sacrament and laments a world that trampled down the truth and drunkards alike. But the consul's melodrama invariably gets exposed and chastised. As another character puts it, do you realize that while you're battling against death, or whatever you imagine you're doing, while what is mystical in you is being released, or whatever it is you imagine is being released, while you're enjoying all this, do you realize what extraordinary allowances are being made for you by the world which has to cope with you? When other characters chastise the consul, it's also Lowry chastising himself for the extraordinary allowances made on his behalf. The book reads like a drunkard's grandiosity punctured by an author who wants to exercise the fantasies fueling his own drinking. The consul's drunk body constantly interrupts his lyrical indulgences. The will of man is unconquerable, he explains, then falls asleep. He is suddenly overwhelmed by sentiment, as at the same time by a violent attack of hiccups. Drinking is a thwarted flight into transcendence, like a dog chained to a post, barking at the sky. When the consul delivers a rhapsodic monologue about the enchanted splendor of a cantina in the early morning, Yvonne interrupts to ask if their gardener is left for good. The garden is a mess. the consul remains undeterred. He has nothing but love songs for the ragged divinity of barfly living. How, unless you drink as I do, can you hope to understand the beauty of an old woman from Tarasco who plays dominoes at 7 o'clock in the morning? One senses that, to the consul, the woman playing dominoes at the bar is still beautiful at 8 in the morning, and 9 in the morning, and 10 at night. One senses that the consul wants to believe he is the only one who can see it. Ah, none but he knew how beautiful it all was. The sunlight, 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 flooding the bar of El Puerto del Sol, flooding the watercress and oranges. The ah becomes a recurring textual street sign. Beware melodrama ahead. But the consul's insistence on the singularity of his own drunk vision is perpetually undermined by the sleeve-tugging queries of the practical world, the messy garden, an attack of hiccups. The consul's tragedy isn't the tragedy of higher meaning, it's the tragedy of absent meaning, the fact that his suffering might not mean anything at all. Critic Michael Wood calls it a great book about missing grandeur, about the specialized tragedy that lies in the unavailability of the tragedy you want. The consul is constantly imagining the epic stories that might include him. Vague images of grief and tragedy flicked in his mind. Somewhere, a butterfly was flying out to sea. Lost. Lost. One imagines the newspaper headlines playing like ticker tape inside the consul's tipsy sense of history. Small orange butterfly not sure which way is north. Man gets drunk and finds everything profound. Under the Volcano ultimately granted Lowry a certain literary pedestal, garnering lasting acclaim that Jackson never received. But Lowry's drinking only got worse after the novel made him famous. Success may be the worst possible thing that could happen to any serious author, he wrote to his mother-in-law. He was a wreck when he came to New York to celebrate his reviews. He is the original consul in the book, observed someone who saw him on that trip. A curious kind of person, handsome, vigorous, drunk, with an aura of genius about him and a personal electricity almost dangerous, demon-possessed. His delirium tremens got so bad he couldn't hold a pencil. Lowry's intelligence could see the drinking from every angle, but he couldn't find a way out of it. A little self-knowledge is a dangerous thing, says the consul's half-brother, not so fond of sobriety himself. We see this self-knowledge lodged in the novel like a worm at the bottom of a tequila bottle. It didn't save anyone. Dave and I threw a miracle berry party that January. This meant everybody got a little purple pill that made everything turn sweet. We served lemons and limes and grapefruits. You could bite into them whole, like apples. They tasted like candy. It was the middle of winter, and my kitchen was hot with the bodies of graduate students. I drank beer that tasted like chocolate and wine that tasted like syrup, and at a certain point, the night flickered into blackout. People were there, and then they weren't. It was just me and Dave in bed. Then it was me and Dave in bed, but it was morning. This was the first real blackout I'd had with him, the first time I'd let myself go that far. After a blackout, memory deals out bits of the night before like a partial poker hand. You get pieces of the picture, but never find out exactly what hand you played. I asked Dave what had happened. Had I embarrassed myself in front of everyone, or was it only obvious after they'd gone? Only after they'd gone, he said, I think. This was good news. I was scared, he said. You weren't making sense. Dave wasn't usually someone who said things like, I was scared, but there it was. I'd been muttering, upset, incomprehensible. When we got up to clean the kitchen, it was cold, and my backyard was glazed with frost beyond my attic windows, glinting in the pure, harsh light of winter. A squirrel had gotten himself to the top of a telephone pole and didn't seem able to get down again. I thought he looked terrified. Dave thought maybe he was just triumphant. The winter light was gorgeous, sharp and crystalline, but I didn't feel entitled to it. It was like the consul, as Lowry described him. He had lost the son. It was not his son. Meanwhile, the kitchen was a mess. Everything that had been sweet was simply itself again, shriveled or crusted. Plastic red cups were everywhere. When Dave lifted a spoon from the table and the paper plate beneath it lifted as well, sticky with wine, it looked like the plate was floating in air. Dave saw the floating plate. I saw the stain of wine. He wanted to take a picture. Levitation. I was already thinking, will I drink again tonight? And where? And when? When I pictured Peter's black eye from his fall, I tried to imagine how he'd struck his face or where else he was bruised and wondered who was taking care of him. I wondered if he'd taken a night off getting drunk. Maybe a Monday. It was as if Peter and I were still inside something together, something that had to do with the drinking. In that way, we were more alike than I would ever be like Dave. I was pregnant when we threw our Miracle Berry party, though I didn't know it yet. When I took a pregnancy test a few weeks later, in a bathroom tucked deep in the labyrinthine corridors of a massive Gothic castle on campus, the plus sign made something bloom in me. Joy and terror at once. Dave met me after one of my seminars, which I'd spent twitchy and distracted, listening to other people talk about post-colonial departures from traditional lyric forms. It was early February. Flinty skies over weathered stone, grass trodden and defeated under patches of snow. Dave took my gloved hand in his gloved hand and asked me what I wanted to do. He said, I will stick by you no matter what you choose. It surprised me, not that he would stick by me, but that he was approaching the moment as a choice. I couldn't imagine having a baby, not right then, just a few months into our love, when everything was just beginning. The fact that Dave was willing, that he was saying he would summon himself for that, for a lifetime of parenting together, made the possibility actual. I pictured him teaching a small, floppy-haired boy to play the guitar. I pictured him listening to our daughter's make-believe story, asking her questions. How did the little squirrel learn to be less afraid? Once I talked to him, I was more aware of the loss than I had been on my own. The loss of a creature we had created with our bodies and then created again, with our conversation that day in the brittle chill, putting our imaginations toward the possibility of a shared life. Once I realized I was pregnant, I was repulsed by how much I'd been drinking. I pictured a not-yet baby built of gin, with little thin feet and cauliflower hands, pickled inside me. But I didn't stop. If I was going to have an abortion, what difference did it make? It still made me sick, picturing the fetus like a tiny ice cube cloaked in whiskey. I was nervous about the recovery, afraid of seeming needy or unappealing, afraid of being wanted less. How long would we have to wait to have sex again? On the morning I got the abortion, Dave held my hand as we walked past the protesters outside Planned Parenthood. Elderly, in lawn chairs, holding the same poster board they always held, a webby mess of tissue and blood. I was angry at them for all the women they'd spooked and shamed, but I also felt a sorrow I couldn't account for. It had to do with the way they spent so many of their days on these lawn chairs, grieving. When I got out, 3 hours later, I was grateful for Dave's hand, grateful for the smell and solidity of him, the grain of his beard stubble against my cheek. He hugged me, hard, for long moments, in the middle of the waiting room. Years later, he wrote a poem that ended with that same memory of our bodies together. They kiss each other in the middle of a waiting room and cry because they are not thinking of how they will be seen. I couldn't remember kissing in the waiting room or crying, but I could remember precisely what it had been like, not thinking of being seen. I could remember his embrace as enfolding, absolute. A month after the abortion, I had heart surgery to correct persistent tachycardia, episodes of rapid, gratuitous heartbeats that I was told would slowly wear out my heart before its time. I wasn't going to fall down dead if it wasn't treated, but I might not live as long. This was interesting to me. I wasn't saving my life now. I was giving more years to a future version of myself. I was preserving her. It was the second time I was asking Dave to take care of me, right on the heels of the abortion. After nights I'd spent lying awake in bed beside him, twisting with the hot, swirled knot of a pain I hadn't quite expected. When he woke, he rubbed my back and whispered into my neck. There was something I liked about the dynamic, being cared for, being understood as vulnerable. But it made me feel ashamed to find any part of it appealing. The night before the surgery, I was careful to drink only a few glasses of wine. This seemed prudent, to make sure there wasn't too much stray booze running through my system when I went into surgery the next morning. Before we went to bed, I told Dave I was nervous. What if it didn't work? What if something went wrong and I ended up with a pacemaker? I'd been told this was unlikely, but possible. What I saw on Dave's face then was an expression I hadn't seen before. A hardening, as if the blood had cooled into a solid gel beneath his skin. "You shouldn't worry," he said. "What good would it do?" I was suddenly embarrassed, like I had done something wrong by worrying or burdened him by speaking it. I didn't say anything more. After I woke up from surgery, the surgeons told me it hadn't worked. My cardiologist came to my hospital bed with a bottle of pills, a beta blocker called Sotalol, that I was supposed to start taking instead. The drug was strong enough that I had to stay in the hospital for 3 more days while they tracked its effect on my heart. When I noticed a little martini glass on the side with an X through it, I immediately hid my dread behind casual questions. "Was this pro forma?" I asked hopefully. "Just a generally not a good idea to be drinking on medication situation? Or was it serious?" I wanted the cardiologist to bottom line it. Could I drink or not? The doctor suggested I not drink for a few months and we'd see how it went. Sure. And maybe I could also spend a few months never using my hands. I was frustrated not just by the prospect of not drinking anything at all, but also by the idea that this wouldn't be a big deal, that we could just wait and see. Dave spent nights with me in the hospital. He brought me bread pudding, our 2 plastic forks sticking out of the wobbly vanilla loaf, and he learned which drawer at the nurse's station held extra stashes of the graham crackers I liked. He made them sacred, those hospital days. But there were certain things that confused me. When I was discharged and he came to pick me up, for example, he called from the car. "Can you just meet me down here?" he said. "I don't want to park." I'd been in a hospital bed for 5 days, but didn't want to ask for extra help. It seemed like I'd already asked for too much of it. So I hoisted my duffel bag on my shoulder and came down, had to sit down in the elevator right on the cold, dirty floor so I wouldn't faint. When I got in the car, I said nothing. I could remember the look on Dave's face when I'd told him I was scared before the surgery, and I didn't want to see it again. Once I got home from the hospital, I decided the doctor's advice about not drinking was just advice. She would have been more adamant and less casual if it wasn't. It was advice I decided not to follow. We could just see, I thought. This meant trying to cut back on drinking, failing to cut back on drinking, and not taking my heart medication whenever I'd drunk a lot, which seemed like due diligence. I also Googled Sotalol alongside every type of alcohol I could think of to see if I could find reassurance that it was okay, or else a warning dire enough to make me stop drinking entirely. About a month later, my cardiologist ordered something called a Holter monitor to test if my medication was working. It was a box I wore around my neck for 24 hours, attached to EKG monitors stuck to my chest that measured my heart rate. I told myself I wouldn't drink for the day I was wearing it. I didn't want to fuck up the results. I was stuffed with internet wisdom. Drinking alcohol affects how well Sotalol works, the New Zealand Medicines and Medical Devices Safety Authority had said in bolded letters, quoting the drug company, and I believed them. If I drank with my Holter monitor, I imagined the data would be incriminating evidence, my heart rate spiking around twilight. But then I went to a reading on campus, and it seemed weird, almost ungrateful, not to have one glass of wine afterward. It was free. And before I knew it, I was sitting at a bar downtown with a friend, drinking a martini with my weird little heart contraption dangling around my neck. A week later, my cardiologist called to say the Sotalol wasn't working. I had to stay in the hospital for another 3 days while they tested the new drug, whose bottle also had a little martini glass with an X over it. So I switched drugs, kept drinking, kept Googling, this time with a new drug in the search bar. Flecainide plus alcohol plus death. That spring, Dave found out he had been accepted at the writer's workshop, and we flew to Iowa to look at apartments, giddy at figuring out the contours of our new life in a new town. We'd been together about 5 months, and his acceptance felt like fate co-signing on our giddiness. For Dave, a child of the Boston suburbs, it was his first time west of the Mississippi. We rented a second-floor apartment in a white farmhouse down the street from the local co-op, only a few minutes' walk from where I'd lived 5 years earlier, for that first year of bonfires and blackouts. This was a different sort of thrill, making a home together so quickly, like putting down a huge bet on a promising pocket pair in Texas Hold'em before you know the flop, the turn, or the river. I was ready to return to Iowa with the things I'd wanted, back when I lived there the first time. A man and a bit of success, two measures of value I'd always understood as linked. Dave was elated at the thought of spending 2 years writing poems, as opposed to writing about poems, which he'd been doing in our doctoral program, and excited to move to a town that didn't hold 8 years of his past. In those days, I was editing my novel, still drinking, and still writing my heavy drinking character as a woman with whom I had nothing in common. My editor told me she wanted the novel to dramatize the possibility of recovery, as narrative tension, even if it got thwarted. What if I included an AA meeting, or even a stretch of sobriety? I'd never been to an AA meeting, and couldn't really imagine one. I pictured folding chairs in a church basement, styrofoam cups of steaming coffee. That was it. But I didn't want to go to one for research. Perhaps some part of me was nervous about what I'd hear. So I summoned a vague sketch and wrote about Tilly watching people who were part of something, making coffee, trading phone numbers, swapping life stories, and deeming herself a failure in comparison because her sobriety consisted of memorizing the TV schedule and watching the clock. That was all I could grant sobriety. Even Mondays without drinking had been bad enough. Tilly goes to the AA meeting with her adult son, who walks out partway through because he doesn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there either, in the scene, or writing it. As Tilly watches her son leave, she thinks about the difference between them, that he could walk out of the room because he didn't live in the world she lived in, a world defined by ceaseless longing. I wasn't yet sure which world I lived in, whether I was someone who could stand up and awkwardly pick her way between the folding chairs, walk out on thirst like a lover I was done with, or whether I had to stay in the room, a room full of people who had to do something about their constant wanting. In his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Gabor Maté, the clinician who worked with Skid Row addicts in Vancouver, compares addicts to hungry ghosts on the Buddhist wheel of life, creatures with scrawny necks, small mouths, emaciated limbs, and large, bloated, empty bellies. Their bodies are physical expressions of that aching emptiness that drives addiction, what Maté describes as a search for something outside ourselves to curb an insatiable appetite for relief or fulfillment. But for Maté, addicts don't have a monopoly on the quest. They have much in common with the society that ostracizes them. In the dark mirror of their lives, we can trace the outlines of our own. To argue that addiction holds a dark mirror up to more universal hungers isn't a denial of its physical mechanisms, neurotransmitters and their adaptations, or a denial of chemical dependence as a discrete phenomenon with its own physiological reality. It's simply an acknowledgement that the operative urges of addiction aren't unrelated to desires that show up in everyone. The urge to court bliss, to dull pain, to find relief. For decades, much of the scientific research on addiction suggested a certain inevitability in its mechanisms, as if it operated outside of context, compelled by its own unique velocity. From the late 60s to the late 80s, the scientific studies that got the most press, and often the best funding, were the ones where caged animals were trained to give themselves drugs until they did so compulsively. One laboratory joke maintained that the definition of a drug was any substance that, when given to a rat, produced a journal article. Rats pushed the cocaine lever until they died. These journal articles eventually turned into household wisdom and after-school specials. Cocaine Rat was the title of a 1988 PSA video that showed a white rat gnawing pellets in desperation until it keeled over, its little claws fumbling in the air, its matted fur shadowed by the bars of its cage. "It's called cocaine," said the voiceover, "and it can do the same thing to you." But the voiceover didn't explain that these rats, the ones that pressed the coke lever until they died, were kept alone in bare white cages. They had injection apparatuses implanted in their backs. They were often starved. A few scientists eventually wondered, what if they were given some company? What if they were given something else to do? In the early 80s, these scientists designed Rat Park, a spacious plywood habitat painted with pine trees and filled with climbing platforms, running wheels, tin cans for hiding, wood chips for playing, and, most important, lots of other rats. The rats in that cage didn't press the coke lever until they died. They had better things to do. The point wasn't that drugs couldn't be addictive, but that addiction was fueled by so much besides the drugs themselves. It was fueled by the isolation of the white cage and by the lever as substitute for everything else. Most addicts don't live in barren white cages, though some do once they've been incarcerated, but many live in worlds defined by stress of all kinds, financial and social and structural, the burdens of institutional racism and economic inequality, the absence of a living wage. The original cover of George Cain's Blues Child Baby featured a drawing of a black man tying off his arm with a strip of the American flag, popping out the veins for his next dose of heroin. What was it that did, in reality, make me an opium eater? Thomas De Quincey wondered in 1821. Misery, blank desolation, abiding darkness. Most addicts describe drinking or using as filling a lack. I once met a woman who described herself as a bucket that had sprung a leak, and she kept trying to fill it. With liquor, with affirmation, with love. David Foster Wallace once called booze the interior jigsaw's missing piece. The leaky bucket and the missing puzzle piece are visions of Sedgwick's self, thus self-construed as lack. Though these circular statements of cause, you drink to fill the lack, the drinking deepens it, all raise the same question. Where does the lack come from? I could tell you 1,001 stories about mine. I could tell you a story about the men in my family, as I've already started to, about my frequent flyer father, my godly brothers and their powerful reserve, and how a self comes into its shape by seeking. This is the depth psychology fairy tale, airplane ticket stubs as smoking gun. Aha! But I've always distrusted the neatness of this story. Dime store psychoanalysis, turning wounds to tarot cards, or the ways it seemed to blame my relationship to substances on people who have spent my whole life loving me. My childhood was easier than most, and I ended up drinking anyway. Maybe I need to tell a different story about lack. Maybe it wasn't about my father's life on airplanes so much as his wiring, the parts of his genetic code he passed along to me, The chromosomal variations we shared that made our neural systems more primed to coax dependencies. I imagine tracing our chromosomal inheritance back through generations. My father, his father, who knows how many fathers before him, all the way back through the whiskey-strung branches of our family tree. I can't even count how many free shots of whiskey our surname has secured for me over the years, as if my alcoholic ancestors were raising a glass in my direction. Or maybe the lack is systemic. I was born into late capitalism, an economic system that sold me on the notion that I was insufficient, so it could sell me on the notion that consumption was the answer to my insufficiency. It's true that people loved getting fucked up long before capitalism, but it's also true that one of the core promises of capitalism, transformation through consumption, is another version of the promise addiction makes. Make something of yourself. This is one of the secular articles of faith in the American gospel of productivity. So I spent years making as much as I could, as well as I could. But at the end of the day, more specifically, at the end of each day, I was exhausted by all that making and wanted the chatter of these exhortations quieted. So, gin. So, wine. If we imagine the story of the lack as something encoded within us, an internal set of blueprints for a sense of absence, then it's a story that is still being written. The Collaborative Studies on Genetics of Alcoholism is an ongoing research project running since 1989 that has interviewed and sampled blood from more than 17,000 members of over 2,200 families, trying to illuminate the specific genetic factors that put people at risk for alcoholism, trying to substantiate, in a broader sense, my father's conviction that drinking was more dangerous for us. The COGA study has linked certain phenotypes, observable characteristics, to specific DNA regions on various chromosomes. The low level of response phenotype, i.e., you need to drink more to feel the same thing, and the alcohol dependence phenotype were both linked to the same region on chromosome 1, while the maximum number of drinks ever consumed in a 24-hour period phenotype, usually 9 or more, was a sign of trouble, was linked to a region on chromosome 4. The evidence supporting a genetic basis for alcoholism is pretty much indisputable. Which is to say, we're all dependent, but some people are more dependent than others, and different forms of dependence deform our lives in different ways. My drinking had something to do with my family, and something to do with my brain, and something to do with the values I was raised to worship. Excellence, enchantment, superlative everything. All these tales of why are true and also insufficient. A state of insufficiency is part of being human, and I responded to my particular state of insufficiency by drinking. Because I was wired for it and groomed for it. Because once I started doing it, it was so eloquent in its delivery of a particular bodily guarantee. With this, you will feel like enough. Drinking promised a version of consciousness that didn't mean endless twisting and turning in the bedsheets of myself, tangled and restless, aching for dreams. Booze promised relief from the default state of needing something from men. It was an object I could always make available. But when it broke these promises, again and again, it also sharpened the need that made me crave it in the first place. It was a bait and switch. It promised bliss and offered shame. It promised self-sufficiency and offered dependence. It also felt really fucking good. But it was always just a temporary flight. When I returned to myself each morning, the groove of lack had just grown deeper, more stubbornly etched, like a skip, skip, skip in the song. The summer before we moved to Iowa, I turned 26 in a little town called Rio Maggiore on Italy's Ligurian coast, where Dave and I were spending our final graduate student stipend checks, impulsively, romantically, unwisely, on a little apartment overlooking the Mediterranean. Rio Maggiore was arranged around a single steep road running from the hills down to the sea, where fishing boats bobbed around a wooden ramp jutting into the waves. Tall, narrow houses crowded the road like crooked teeth. Painted shades of fuchsia, buttercream, tangerine, mint, and rose. For some reason, all the window shutters were painted green. Dave and I sat on the rocks by the water, baking in the sun, and made up stories to explain why they'd all been painted the same color. Well, it definitely had to do with a woman, Dave said. Maybe an affair, I suggested. We imagined a woman with pistachio eyes and the mayor who couldn't have her, so he made a rule that all the town's shutters had to be painted the same shade as her eyes, as an oblique homage to his hidden love. That week was full of play, pinning notes to each other on the clothesline outside our kitchen window, next to my salt-crusted bikini, and cooking a local dish called Octopus in Hell, which involved tomatoes, olive oil, and patience. The restaurants in town served wine in pitchers, the way restaurants back home served water, and being on vacation somewhere beautiful made it less awkward to get tipsy every night. I'd never told Dave I wasn't supposed to drink on my heart medication, so he never bothered me about it. But every once in a while, lying in bed at night after too much booze, my heart went wild, hammering under my ribs. Dave loved a local cake called torta di riso, made from rice and orange rind, and convinced himself that the elderly woman who ran a bakery near the dock was going to teach him how to make it. She's not just going to invite a stranger back into her kitchen, I told him. We'll see, he shrugged, smiling, and the next thing I knew, he was standing over a flour-dusted butcher block table in the woman's ancient kitchen, learning how to simmer the rice in milk steeped with orange peels and a single, monstrous brown vanilla pod. Dave thought he could charm his way into everything. Most of the time, he could. One afternoon, we were lying in bed after sex, talking about Milton's Paradise Lost, one of the books I had to prepare for my oral exams that September, and I was busy defending Eve. She'd been framed. Well, he said, you can't really say Eve wasn't responsible for the fall. If you were made from someone's fucking rib, I said, you might want to eat from the tree of knowledge too. The serpent was preying on her vanity, he said. Somehow our voices grew edgier. I didn't like that I was naked and pulled the sheets tighter around my body. It was less about the argument itself. Eve was guilty, Adam was guilty, the serpent was guilty, no one was clean. That was the whole point. And more that neither one of us could let go. Both of us needed to be right. For my birthday, Dave told me he was going to teach me how to ride a bike. From the moment he realized that I'd never learned, he'd been determined to teach me. It'll be amazing, he said. You'll always remember this birthday as the one where you learned to ride a bike. Okay, I said, because I didn't want to disappoint him. But in truth, I didn't want to spend my birthday learning how to ride a bike. I wanted to lie on the rocks in the sun and make up stories about window shutters and drink red wine from ceramic pitchers. We rented a bike and took it to a dirt path running through the hills above the town. The sun beat down, and I kept trying and tipping over and trying and tipping over. Dave steadied the bike and pushed me from behind. Just pedal, he said. Just trust it. But I couldn't trust. Being afraid of falling is what makes you fall, he said, which only made the whole thing seem like a verdict on my character. For an hour we tried, me pedaling, the bike tipping, him bewildered and amused. My nerves gave way to a brute physical frustration that eventually made me kick the bike like a kid throwing a tantrum. I started crying. Can we just stop? I said. It frustrates you to not be in control, he said, dead calm. I just want to stop, I said. After a few more tries, he said, the disappointment plain across his face. When I looked at it from his perspective, my reaction seemed absurd. He'd planned this whole afternoon to celebrate my birthday, and I'd ruined it by getting upset. But my fear of disappointing him was a raw panic in my gut. Not something I could control. I just wished he could have said, you hate this. Let's stop. So much of our play, the stories we made up, the notes we exchanged, our little fights about books was about impressing each other. Sometimes it got exhausting. On our last night, we sat in rickety wooden chairs on our balcony and ate melon wrapped in fatty prosciutto, pocked with sea salt, drank wine from mugs, watched lightning crack in sharp, sudden knife blades over the water. The bike lesson was just an absurdity in the rearview mirror. Why had I been crying? There was music coming from a church on the hill. We got up and danced, took off our clothes, felt the cool salt air and the warmth of each other's bodies. In Milan, on our way home, we drank martinis by the green canals, strolling past antique stores selling junked gilded bird cages and cafes where women smoked long cigarettes through frosted pink lips while Serge Gainsbourg played from secret speakers. Woozy and drunk, grateful for the world as stage set and soundtrack to our love, I was sure we'd get married someday, and our life would be made of nights like these. This was what drinking felt like when it still felt good. It felt good to drink cloudy pastis in a pub that summer, playing cards with Dave and his brothers, staining our mouths crimson with cheap house red. It felt good to drive out to a friend's cottage and pass a bottle of whiskey around a bonfire, roasting marshmallows over the flames and wrapping garlic bread in tin foil to make it bubbling hot. It felt good to drink cold red stripes on the porch of our new apartment in Iowa, to drink white wine in the humid kitchen, our humid kitchen, while I garnished plates of risotto, the first meal I'd ever cooked for him. That night I'd sliced my thumb. These were the nights, on the balcony, in the pub, by the bonfire, I carried as proof, saying, "See, it can be perfect," wanting so badly to believe that the drinking could electrify everything without price. At first, life with Dave in Iowa was luminous. Late summer evenings on our wooden porch, eating sweet corn and zebra tomatoes tossed into crude, perfect salads with Amish goat cheese and ripped hunks of baguette. We spent afternoons playing pinball in dim bars, giving ourselves faint mustaches of beer foam as silver balls pinged through the sticky quiet hours. We went for brunch at a friend's cottage by the river, found him frying bacon in the kitchen, smoking a cigarette over the stove. That morning smelled like coffee and smoke, tasted like the sizzling salt heat of the bacon, glinted like sun off the river. Dave loved the world of writers in Iowa City, the community and bohemian allure of it, the vapor-like quality of Iowa socializing, how it would expand to fill as much time as you wanted to give it. Conversations spilling across the edges of hours, nights ending where you hadn't expected them to end, walking the visiting poet back to where he was staying as dawn broke over Dodge Street, or riffing about parataxis on someone's busted brown corduroy couch. Dave had left the dry, airless corridors of scholarship to live a more expansive life, to live another version of the early 20s he'd spent more domestically, in a 4-year relationship with an older woman. But I was growing tired of home-pickled vegetables and drunken poetry recitations. "These potlucks are ridiculous," I thought. "Who could attend so many in a week?" Part of me just felt excluded. The poets had their seminars by the river and their bar nights after class, and I had early shifts at the bakery where I'd started working 3 or 4 days a week to pay my share of the rent. I woke at 6 in the morning and walked a mile to a little yellow house by the railroad tracks, owned and run by a woman named Jamie. Funny, efficient, demanding, someone with no time for bullshit. When I came in to ask for a job and she asked if I had any bakery experience, I'd said, "Not really," then, "Not at all," and she hired me anyway. In a cramped kitchen, with an 8-foot double oven and a walk-in freezer stocked with frozen slabs of dough, we made chocolate raspberry cakes and sticky buns and banana bread, all our bodies moving in a fluid choreography between the prep counters and the cake island. The floor mixer was as tall as a little man and had 4 speeds and a gear transmission, like a car. "It's a Hobart," my boss told me, as if I was supposed to understand what that meant. My beat was sugar cookies in seasonal shapes, leaves and pumpkins during my first few months, as well as front of the house, running the register, bussing tables, pulling espresso shots. I loved the job. Jamie intimidated me. Around her, I felt timid and meek, but it was nice to have a place where I was needed, if not exactly skilled. The bakery was also introducing me to a different version of Iowa City than I'd known the first time around, when I hadn't had a single number in my cell phone with a 319 prefix, the local area code, because everyone in my life was from somewhere else. Now, I got texts from my boss asking me to pick up shifts, or from the head baker, a guy my own age with a massive, unfinished tattoo on his biceps, a sense of humor perched between sarcasm and cheesiness, and two kids, a toddler and a baby, who texted me photos of his perfect meringues to brag. When my boss brought her 5-year-old daughter into the shop, I would pull over a stool and ask her to help me wash dishes in the industrial 3-tub sink in the back. We'd both get our arms fully soaked. At the workshop, everyone was basically between the ages of 22 and 35, stylish and sharp. But the people in my world at the bakery wore less black and smiled more. I got to know the couple in their 50s who came in every day at 7:30 and ordered coffee and morning biscuits, like scones, with a dollop of strawberry jam, and asked me how my book was going, and I lied and said, "Great," when in truth, I hadn't begun it. Back home, in our white farmhouse at the corner of Dodge and Washington, life with Dave wasn't exactly unfolding as a parade of midnight train station picnics. It was often spent arguing about something in the kitchen, like where to put the rolling dishwasher with only 3 wheels, the one Dave had insisted on bringing with us, or who should wash the pile of dishes in the sink, because the dishwasher was too much trouble to roll anywhere. It only had 3 wheels. Our life was spent scheduling the internet guy and scanning the right documents to get me enrolled as a domestic partner for health insurance. Life was the rent and the fickle vacuum cleaner and the slow creep of silence. A silence I wanted to understand as intimacy, but couldn't help reading as decay, as we sat quietly at our kitchen table over godly tomatoes. Have we run out of things to say? These changes were only ordinary, but I'd never stuck around to watch love become daily. I was afraid Dave would regret the life we'd made together, afraid I couldn't constantly produce a version of myself that he'd like enough to choose over everyone else, which I believed was a requirement of love. Wasn't that the difference between love and compromise? When I drank, my fears attached to objects of fixation that seemed petty when I spoke them out loud. Dave flirting with other girls, Dave making plans without me. Every time Dave stayed out late, or seemed distant or bored, or simply quiet, I got nervous. Was this a sign that he was slightly less invested than he'd been? Slightly less entertained? I was haunted by the words he'd used about his last relationship. Grooves of domesticity. Claustrophobic. The only person in my family who had never gotten divorced was one uncle who lived on a farm in New Mexico, where his wife trained sheepdogs and sunset fired their alfalfa bales with scarlet light. But they seemed superhuman. Dave was not a farmer, and I was not a trainer of dogs. We could barely get the 3-wheeled dishwasher across the kitchen to our sink faucet. We spent much of that first Iowa autumn flying to other people's weddings, where we were inevitably asked when we were planning to get married ourselves, as if we'd entered hunting range during open season. We bought the cheapest plane tickets we could find and ended up in deserted Midwestern airports at ungodly hours. I fell off the end of a moving sidewalk in St. Louis at 4 a.m, and Dave helped me up, both of us laughing. We were inside some pocket of time and space that was just ours, full of empty moving sidewalks, an odd dream we were building together. During that first autumn in Iowa, I watched Dave for signs that our relationship had been tarnished by proximity and tedium. I watched his poems, wondering if the she was always me. I watched his phone, wondering who was texting him. The workshop itself had become a rival, something he might love more than me. When he was in the shower one afternoon, I finally did what I'd been imagining doing for weeks. Picked up his phone, palms sweating, afraid of what I'd find or that he'd catch me finding it, and scrolled through his texts. All I wanted was the complete inventory of his heart and mind. That was it, nothing more. I need a pipeline directly from my brain to yours, he'd told me once. I wanted that too, so I could convince myself that I'd never have to doubt anything, that uncertainty wasn't native to love, and I wouldn't ever have to reckon with it. I found a long swath of messages he'd exchanged over the course of several weeks with a girl in the workshop named Destiny. She was 22 or something close, the same age I'd been at the workshop 5 years earlier, and when I saw a poem he'd texted to her line by line, I got sick to my stomach. It was one he'd just written. I knew because he'd read it to me, but I thought I'd been the only one he'd shared it with. Their messages were daily and affectionate, and sometimes I could tell they'd been meeting up. At Java House now? And then, we'll be there in 10 min. Or, see you at G's tonight? With a little punctuation, smiley face at the end. Their aliveness, their dailiness, their back-and-forth energy came like a sudden slap, a confirmation of my fears. He would always crave the sharp, tingling sensation of falling for someone rather than having her. That's what I told myself then, when of course I was afraid that I needed these things, needed newness and thrill. That's part of why I imagined he couldn't live without them. When Dave got out of the shower, I stewed in miserable, sullen silence until he finally asked if we should talk. We sat on the steps of our front porch, side by side, staring at the little gazebo in the park across the street. I looked at your phone, I told him. He glanced at me. Did you find what you were looking for? I saw your text to Destiny. I paused. He said nothing. You texted her that whole poem, I said. My words sounded plaintive to my ears, pathetic. Why were you checking my phone? I'm sorry, I said, and I was. But I also felt righteous, like he should be apologizing to me. I shouldn't have, I said. I know, but what, he said. There was an edge to his voice. But I was right, I said, starting to cry. I mean that there was something happening. Nothing's happening, he said. His calmness was deliberate and sure-footed. When you flirt like that with someone, I said, something is happening. I have the right to friendships, he said. I promise you, I said, she doesn't think this is just a friendship. Whatever she thinks, I know where the lines are, he said. I haven't crossed them. Remember how you texted me, I asked, before we got together? During the weeks before Dave had finally kissed me, our texts had thrilled me, their constant back and forth, like tin can phones stretched between two bedrooms. I could remember getting out of Peter's bed to check for them. I wasn't the one in a relationship, he said. And of course he was right. Now I'm with you. Exactly, I said. When you're with someone, you're not supposed to be this way with other people. This way, he said. What's that exactly? His voice was chilled and steely, almost a shield, as if he were tucking himself behind it. The icier he got, the shriller my own voice became. Flirting like this, I said. Texting every day, making her... You call it flirting, I call it friendship, he said. How do you define flirting anyway? You just know it, I said. You know it when you're doing it. The real issue, he said, is why you wanted to read my texts in the first place. I didn't answer, couldn't even look at him. Glanced down, instead, at the splintery wood of our porch steps beneath us. But we both knew. I was afraid. Watch out, he said. Your fear will make the things you fear come true. The fight we had that night was like many of the fights that would follow, circling around certain questions, what counted as flirting, that became our ways of talking about freedom and fear. You can just feel it, I repeated, yelling now, knowing I sounded ridiculous, but thinking, can't you? I hurled myself against his refusal to apologize, apologizing myself for violating his privacy, though my apologies always returned to some but. Didn't he understand why a woman wouldn't want her boyfriend texting poems, line by line, to another woman? Eventually, he said we should try to fall asleep. It was 3 in the morning. We'd been fighting for hours. I splashed cold water on my face, watermelon splotchy, swollen from crying, and tried to imagine him looking at this face, degraded by insecurity and need, and loving it anyway, and I couldn't imagine it at all. In bed, Dave fell asleep quickly. Fighting made him tired. But I was wide awake, on high alert from conflict, and hated sensing the stiffness of his body beside mine, the gap between our limbs. Fighting sent a surge of adrenaline through me when all I really wanted was to retire from consciousness for a while. I went into my office to drink because I couldn't sleep and kept drinking until I could settle into numbness. Things were still ugly, but their ugliness didn't much bother me. This started to become a pattern, drinking alone, in my office, after Dave was asleep. In the morning, I'd check my sent folder to see if there were emails I'd sent during blackouts. Once I saw I'd written to my sister-in-law. Do you ever feel like you are completely outside our life? I feel so lonely. Does this make sense to you? It probably doesn't. It doesn't make sense to anyone as bad as I am. I want so much for you to understand this place. I love you. Whenever I was drunk, the stakes were huge, all those capital letter feelings. My darkness was the darkest. Outside, outside, so true I wanted to say it twice. That October, we went to the wedding of one of my best friends, back in New York, held in the garden apartment of her brownstone, rooms full of fashionable people flitting between beet burgers and carrot spears from her husband's farm-to-table restaurant. The charcuterie and cheese tables were luxuriant, like Dutch still lifes, and Dave went to fill our plates while I sat on the staircase with my friend. About 20 minutes later, my friend asked, "Where did Dave go?" When we surveyed the room, we saw him in an animated conversation with the woman manning the cheese table, who was laughing at something he'd said. She was beautiful, even in her ridiculous apron smock, with a messy blonde bun. "I'd lose my shit if my boyfriend spent 20 minutes talking to another woman like that," my friend said. "You're a saint." But I wasn't a saint. I was humiliated. My gaze kept flicking back to Dave, over and over again, though I tried not to, and I kept taking quick, stubborn gulps of wine. I hated the idea that I'd somehow become the woman whose boyfriend was always flirting with other women. By the time he finally returned, triumphantly presenting me with a plate of cave-aged Gouda and sheep's milk manchego, a switch had flipped in me. I was spoiling for a fight. "Let's go outside," I said. "We need to talk." We stood on the sidewalk, on a crisp fall night, on a block of brownstones like a movie set, and my wine breath made little puffy clouds in the cold air when I spoke. "Do you know how embarrassing it is for me?" I asked. "The way you flirt." He bristled at the word flirt, and his body stiffened. "I don't want to be policed," he said. I got more insistent, almost frantic. "It's not just me," I said, reporting what my friend had said, that it would drive her crazy. "This isn't about her," he said. "This is about you." Am I being absurd, I thought. Am I totally fucking insane? But I couldn't get the image of them out of my mind, both laughing, her messy bun, that massive parchment-colored mound of Gouda rising between them, the whole thing like a meet-cute from a romantic comedy. I could imagine the voiceover. So I was at this wedding with my girlfriend, who was actually pretty drunk. "This is my best friend's wedding," I said. "I don't want to spend it on the sidewalk fighting with you." "It was your idea to come out here," he said, which was, maddeningly, accurate. When we went back into the party, the first thing I spotted was a bar counter covered with orderly rows of brimming wine glasses, big and cold, sweating with beaded moisture. I grabbed one immediately. "Are you sure that's what you need?" Dave asked. And yes, I was sure it was. At a party we threw back in Iowa that fall, I got so drunk.